Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Might just be okay. Yeah, and I think we might just be okay. And I think we might just be okay.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Mark Curry? Do y'all like Mark? A self-proclaimed honky-tonk prophet originally from Fort Worth, Texas, Mark Curry lives in Little Rock. More can be found out about him and his various musical projects at monsignormonk.blogspot.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Moreau. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? We feature an artist each week here at Tales for our set art. And this week, our featured artist is Little Rock artist Ken Overstee. For both of these pieces, and the feature piece is this piece here, which a lot of y'all will recognize. And for our listening audience, the piece is called Home of Designing Women, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Ken at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our show is sponsored by the Historic Preservation Alliance of Arkansas and is all about the joys of restoration, whether it's a personal home or a historic building. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Deborah Carroll goes to bat for a neglected building that housed many memories, and will end the night with J.W. King as he restores not one, but two historic houses. But let's start the night with Sandra Spotts Hamilton as she buys an old home to restore and ends up finding more than the past in You Better Think Twice.
The yell seemed to come from nowhere. You buying that house? Startled, I jerked as I put the key in the doorknob. I looked backward, forward, and then to the house next door, finally spotting the owner of the voice, a tiny black woman whom I judged to be in her mid-50s, around my age. Yes, thinking about it, I replied. She yelled back, You better think twice, sister friend. Puzzled, I continued onto the screened-in porch, trying to discern whether she intended the comment as a threat or a neighborly piece of advice. Either way, it couldn't be good news. She walked to the edge of the driveway separating her property from the house my new husband and I had just closed on. With hand on hip, she went on as I paused on the porch. Yeah, I'd sure think twice. I'm Benny D, like Mickey D, but with Benny instead. She chuckled, amused by her own little joke. I answered, Nice to meet you. I'm Sandra. Is there something I don't know about this house? Benny D started crawfishing. Nah, I don't know anything about that house. I'm just saying, she replied, looking up and down my frame. I could almost hear her thinking, That has got to be the whitest woman I have ever met. My husband and I, before we met, had each ended our long-term marriages. We both had been either too generous or too stupid, depending on who's telling the story, to end up with many assets between us, and therefore needed to do some serious scaling down at this point in our lives. We'd convinced ourselves that this house was a great buy and that the area was again on the rise. Both of us had fond childhood memories of the once scenic neighborhood that had grown tatty around the edges. Yeah, we repeatedly told all who would listen, "This is the new Hillcrest," referring to a trendy nearby neighborhood with homes of the same vintage. Except over there, you'd have to add a one in front of the price we're paying. Then we'd chuckle, smug in our business savvy. 2 weeks later, we moved in under the watchful eye of Benny, who sat on her porch with a huge tumbler of something liquid and arms folded across her chest. Every now and then, she was joined by a friend or two who helped her assess the new neighbors. We had painted, floored, and refurbished with the enthusiasm and energy of 20-year-olds. We freed the windows of their bars and planted flowers. I especially loved the multi-paned picture window that looked out onto Benny's front lawn. We remodeled the kitchen and decluttered the patio and backyard. This little bungalow in the new Hillcrest would suit us just fine. After another week of porch sitting and observation, Benny knocked on the door, bearing a plate of glorious smoked ribs whose aroma had our mouths watering all day long. "Made too many. Thought you might could use some." No better gift could have been given to us after a hard day of renovating. We used them, all right, for a huge amount of eating pleasure and as a sign that we'd pass muster for Benny and her friends. This began our occasional swapping of favorite dishes. We settled into the bungalow and met a kitten, Gracie, who had begged, meowed, and gobbled up the food I slipped under the extra work van I left parked in the driveway. She and our kitten had eyed each other through the screened-in porch for days. "Don't feed her. You know that will make her stay. And don't make eye contact," husband had warned. Same husband, a few days later, scooped up a gray-striped furry something at the door and brought it in out of the cold rain. First cat, Kitten Britches, spent a week pouting behind my new draperies before she resigned herself to accept this sibling. They spent the next year of kittenhood careening around the house, sliding on the hardwood floors, knocking over vases, lamps, bowls, and each other. Benny continued to watch us, and we watched back. We definitely got the best value out of this situation. Our weekly cycle of working, coming home, and occasionally grilling on the patio was not much to see, but Benny's activities provided an endless source of entertainment for us. There were loud porch parties with lots of liquid refreshment. She and her friends knew more law than Judge Judy. When the police arrived on more than one occasion, Benny quoted it to them. "I'm still on my porch. You can't touch me on my porch." One summer evening, an argument fueled by refreshments got way out of hand. We watched out the picture window as if we were at a drive-in movie. Betty and her best friend threatened each other in the front yard. One had a garden hoe and one had a kitchen knife. A chase ensued down the street with the ladies yelling and threatening the entire way. When the police showed up, both were sitting serenely on the porch as if they'd been crocheting doilies at the church circle meeting. The young cop came over and asked us what we had seen and told us Benny was well known to the force as far back as when his dad was a cop on the beat downtown where Benny had exercised free enterprise at night. The next spring, we met Slick. We discovered that he disappeared into the 5-foot-high crawl space under Benny's house at night. The space could in no way be called a basement. Curious, we crept over one day when Benny and Slick were gone. The space had been converted into an apartment of sorts, complete with a vinyl floor. Benny had become a landlady to help make ends meet. And soon we found out that in addition to doing yard work around the neighborhood, Slick had taken up freelance grocery sales. One late afternoon, relaxed on the patio as Slick walked down the alley, toting a brown paper bag. "Hey, hey, brother," he shouted to husband, who met him at the fence. Slick continued as he opened the bag. "Want to buy some meat?" He held up 2 frozen pork chops, then half a package of hot dogs, then a raw chicken leg. We were sure, especially since Benny was not home, that Slick's wholesale supplier was Benny's refrigerator. Husband declined the purchase. Months later, we missed Benny for several days. Friends came by to check her house and to pick up her mail. I asked about her and learned that she had been in the hospital with serious heart problems. After her return, the porch parties became less frequent. Friends stopped by to offer care rather than to be entertained. Then on August 2nd, we opened a bottle of champagne to celebrate our first anniversary before going out to dinner. Benny's friend, who had participated in the garden hoe and kitchen knife knockdown dragout, stood in her yard sobbing as an ambulance pulled up. I went out to the screened-in porch. "Benny passed. Benny passed," she sobbed to me. She stopped taking her medicine, couldn't afford it. Wiping tears from my eyes, I walked back into our little bungalow to share the news with husband. We raised our glasses toward the stretcher, bearing our raucous, naughty, but good-hearted neighbor. "Rest in peace, sister friend. Rest in peace." Our dream of a new Hillcrest was soon quashed by the real estate crash, and family circumstances required us to sell our little bungalow and move on. Our improvements allowed us to complete a sale in a matter of days for a nice profit, but no amount of money could have made me want to miss the view from that picture window. I'm glad I didn't think twice.
Sandra Spotts Hamilton is a native of Little Rock, Arkansas, where she works as a designer and writer. She currently lives with her husband, Chuck, and their cats, Gracie Mae and Kitten Bridges, in another renovated home. Next, Deborah Carroll finds that she will do whatever it takes to protect an abandoned downtown building in The Last Movie Palace.
If any of you have ever tried to save an old building, and especially an old opera house or movie theater, then you will understand I was willing to do whatever it took to save it. I can admit it now because I think the statute of limitation is passed for what I did. And since it is just us, I can tell you. It all started in the 1980s when an article in the paper said that they were talking about tearing down the Arkansas Theater on Louisiana Street in Little Rock. I was busy working on a commission and making 150 pair of limited edition dolls for the Arkansas Sesquicentennial. I had a lot of time because I was hand sewing the little cloth dolls. Little felt arms and legs were hanging by clotheslines all over my studio, and it was then that I learned that boys, no matter how much you threaten or bribe them, will not be caught dead stuffing little felt doll arms. Always doing several things at the same time, which I proudly call multitasking, and my husband calls a manic stage, I decided to write a script about saving the theater. Didn't matter that I had no knowledge about writing the script. I'm an Aries, and we think we can do everything. I grew up in Little Rock in the 60s, and I have wonderful memories of taking a bus downtown to go to the movies at the Arkansas Theater. Since I was short, was being the operative word, I got in on a child ticket for a long time. Seems like you could purchase round-trip bus tickets, movie tickets, Coke, popcorn, and a box of mints for less than a dollar. The Arkansas Theater had a wonderful curved staircase that went to the mezzanine level, with stairs going to the left or right. Mom took me and my sisters to a movie there. We had the pretty mom. You know, some moms were Kool-Aid moms, some were picnic in the backyard moms, and ours was the pretty mom. She was sporting her polka dot shirtwaist dress with crinoline slip and high heels. At the top of the stairs was a water fountain with black and pink Art Deco tiles on the walls. To the right was the ladies' room with a round pink bench where you could sit and talk, adjust the seams in your hose, and reapply your lipstick. After watching the women at the curved wall of mirrors doing what women do in bathrooms, we were ready to go back down to stairs to the concession stand. Mom caught her heel in the netting of her slip and fell head over heels down the stairs all the way to the lobby. She stood up, adjusted her dress, picked up her Lucite purse, and with her arms spread wide said, "Ta-da!" We were very embarrassed and shielded our faces so no one would recognize us. In fact, I don't think we've been to a movie with her since. Before it closed in the late 70s, one of the last serious films, Who's the Man That Won't Cop Out When There's Danger All About? Shaft! Right on! But most of the last films were low-budget films like I Dismember Mama and Count Blackula, swept up in the trash in a corner behind the concession stand were small, folded little drinking cups. But the writing on them revealed they were upchuck cups. Really? When was the last time you wanted to throw up in a movie theater? I do have to admit, in the balcony of the theater watching A Clockwork Orange, in a cloud of smoke, cigarette or otherwise, did leave me a little woozy, and the stone girl behind me started laughing and some really strange things did come out of her nose. Y'all were there. Fast forward to the 80s, and little did I know when I was writing that script that I would become one of the characters when I started a one-man campaign to save the theater. After locating the original Kempner family spokesman, I was given a key and anxiously went down the alley to the stage door and unlocked the chain that held the doors together. It took a while to adjust my eyes in the dark, and I didn't realize my foot was close to stepping through a broken board that was open to the water-filled basement. Quickly, I got my bearings, and I felt the wall down the hall and found my way into the main theater. Remnants of red velvet curtains hung lazily over the fly space of the stage, with rays of sunlight pierced through the roof. Through the years, these holes in the roof let the rain fall like a waterfall into the big abandoned popcorn oil barrels stored on the stage. When the barrels filled beyond capacity, their weight just blasted them through the stage into the flooded basement area, where once the secondary stars had used for dressing rooms. When you love old buildings, you're always more curious than afraid. It never bothered me to be in that dark, damp theater by myself. It was just too exciting to be afraid. Under the lobby was a civil defense basement. It was used back in the days when we thought we could duck and cover and get under a desk when we were being protected from an atomic attack. Since the theater had closed, hobos, as they were called back then, would break in and sleep there. The police always ran them out when they tried to start fires to keep warm. In my mind, in my heart, I could see someone wanting to produce my screenplay and film it into the theater as they were restoring it and have the world premiere of Curtain Call Capers after it was fully restored. I found someone interested, but the recipients of the donated theater only saw the value in the land. By that time, I had gathered enough information and artifacts to fill a binder to present to the Arkansas office for nominating a building on the National Register of Historic Places. In the script, there was a scene that took place in a room that was untouched by time, and ghosts of stars from the past stayed there. I had never been in that part of the theater and really didn't even know if it existed, but it was there. There were some old film lobby cards, and some were in the shapes of stars with remnants of glitter around the edges. Years earlier, I was doing a past life regression. Doesn't everyone? And she told me that Howard Keel was my father in another life. So when I found his lobby card from Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, I knew it had to be true. The research revealed that it had originally been called the Kempner Opera House. At one time, it was one of the largest stages in the South other than the Orpheum in Memphis. There had been live animals on the stage, a performance of Ben-Hur, and the biggest star of that time, Sarah Bernhardt, had performed there in one of her last U.S. performances before her death. Even though I had no claim of ownership to this huge brick building in downtown Little Rock, in my mind and in my heart, it was my building to save. After the theater had been closed, the city thought it would be a great place for a bus stop. Busy street, centrally located, and the patrons waiting for the bus could stand under the huge marquee to be protected by the elements. Sorry, but I didn't think that was showing respect to a theater that had once had Sarah Bernhardt performing there. On a few occasions, when exploring the theater, I would make my way up to the front where they had boarded up the lobby doors and the ticket booth. Didn't mean any harm, only wanted to protect my building, but there were rumors of the sounds of howling ghosts, scratching on the boards, and rattling chains, just loud enough to scare the people at the bus stop. Not saying that I did that. It was just rumored to happen. Like I said, some people are willing to do whatever it takes to save something like the Arkansas Theater. In my script, one of the plots was that someone in the Lafayette Hotel wanted the theater torn down for a parking lot. Sadly, 10 years later, it really happened. I read recently where someone suggested that they build a theater in downtown Little Rock. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Deborah Carroll proudly claims Hot Springs, Little Rock, and North Little Rock as her hometowns. Although she's an award-winning author, artist, and sculptor, she enjoys being a grandmother the most. In our final story of the night, J.W. King is restoring homes when he is hassled by some suits not once, but twice in Encounters with Authority.
As a historic restoration tech, i.e. a guy that works on old houses, I've encountered everything from angry hornets and demented homeowners to buildings that should have collapsed already. Even early in my career, I figured I'd seen it all. Culture clash, as well, is no stranger. I've restored buildings from Arkansas to Connecticut, Texas to DC, and Tennessee to South Carolina. So it shouldn't be surprising that I'd eventually encounter something that really couldn't be compared to anything else, until it could. In 1992, while working on the front dormer of a two-story Craftsman home in the 1700 block of Center Street in Little Rock, a loud voice hailed me from below. Looking down, I found two large men in dark suits and sunglasses calling me down from the roof. I recognized them as agents of the United States Secret Service, employed to guard President-elect Bill Clinton, himself in the governor's mansion three doors away. "And keep the gun in plain sight at all times," one admonished. The other agent's hand was buried in his coat near his chest. "Gun," I thought. "I don't have any." "No. No." I smiled as I picked up my caulk gun and descended the ladder. I laughed out loud when they examined the gun closely. I shook my head when they handed it back, telling me I could resume my work. Anyone would have found the incident amusing. I certainly did. But the agents were so stoic, so grim-faced, and so incredibly serious that I kept a rather strained, straight face until I was back on the roof. And for the rest of the job, one of the agents would come to check on me each and every hour. He said nothing, just stared at me from below, undoubtedly looking for drips and sags in the caulk. But even this wasn't the topper. That had already happened 5 years earlier. I was working on an 1873 row house near DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., and the task of rebuilding a brick fireplace hearth fell to me. As luck would have it, the plumbers were also working that day, and with the water turned off at the street, I had to mix my mortar at another construction site almost two blocks away. Hard hats always help other hard hats, especially in historic neighborhoods, and I knew the crew at the other site would lend me some water. So, cutting through the alley in the back of the site, I lugged my 5-gallon bucket of dry mortar to their site, mixed it to the proper consistency, traded a few friendly insults with the carpenters, and headed back through the alley. Halfway down that alley, however, I found myself surrounded by three huge men with crew cuts, each wearing a badly tailored suit and sporting earphones with little braided wires that disappeared into their jackets. I knew something was up, especially when they began speaking angrily in Russian, all the while pointing at my bucket. They may have been big and ugly with an air of authority about them, but I was on a work-related mission. "What, you don't allow mortar in the evil empire?" I snarked. It was probably a good thing they spoke only Russian. They indicated that I was to remain with them for a while by completely blocking my way. "I don't know or care who you are," my now loud voice rose. "You'd better move or get somebody that speaks English." Within 2 minutes, the discussion began to get rather heated as I had work to do, a famously short temper and acid tongue, and no truck with being intimidated by morons. I was never so glad to see the cops when they arrived during the third minute, and I was whisked to the side by one while the other three went toe-to-toe with the Russians. I was happy to let someone else argue with them for a while, though it quickly became obvious that no one understood a word the other was saying. A door in the adjacent building opened, and a fourth Russian emerged. A small, weasel-faced individual with a tired look and a wrinkled suit, he spoke both languages and began to interpret. I found the entire episode to be something out of a strange short story until I heard what was going on. Then I knew I was in that story and that it was stranger than I'd ever imagined. It turned out that this particular stretch of the alley ran behind TASS, the Soviet news agency, and these particular guerrillas were agents of the KGB. They were suspicious of my bucket. "It's mortar, for Christ's sakes," I whined. The Russians insisted that I dump out the contents to prove that there was nothing dangerous hidden in the wet mix, and I countered by telling them to go straight to hell. I even gave them directions, including the floor and the suite. The cops brightened up visibly at the suggestions. Apparently, few people are willing to speak thusly to the KGB. "This isn't Russia," I growled, "and that's my mortar." To my delight, the cops took my side, standing between the KGB and my bucket. "You leave his bucket alone," they said. It was then that I realized that these were not DC cops. They were FPS, Federal Protective Service. This is the uniform branch of the Secret Service. Anyone in DC knows that they are not to be gainsaid. And here we were, having a Cold War standoff in an alley in America's capital. Ronnie Reagan would be proud of me if he knew. As it was, he was only a few blocks away, likely snoozing in the Oval Office. Finally, after much discussion, one of the KGB guys removed his coat. My, what a big gun he had. Rolled up his sleeve, and to the chagrin of the Russians and the smiles of the FPS, plunged his arm into the mix and felt about. Of course, he found nothing but mortar. In the end, four red stony faces and one mortar-covered arm turned away to walk back into the door of the TASS news agency. Once the door closed, the FPS cops erupted into paroxysms of nearly uncontrollable laughter. I'd never seen cops laugh so hard. At least they had a sense of humor, unlike their suit-wearing brethren I had yet to meet on Center Street 5 years later.
J.W. King is a 53-year-old historic restoration project manager in Little Rock who has been doing historic work for 27 years in Arkansas, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Washington, D.C. J.W. has also been writing a newspaper column for 17 years called The Old House Doctor. He hunts gemstones, chases tornadoes, and girls. Sometimes he catches them, sometimes there's trouble. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.